Back from the arduous task of enjoying a vacation of sorts, glad to be back with the arts and culture of Western Wisconsin, where we feel right at home on Spectrum West. Hi, everybody. I'm Al Ross. This week, people working together in promotion of the arts interdepartmentally at a university to make wonderful things happen, and a book with regional historic significance. Ann Katz of Arts Wisconsin is here about a report called 21st Century Wisconsin. It's actually proof of good health for Wisconsin's creative community. Jim Oliver welcomes Lauren Robinson about his book, The 13. Two gentlemen educators from UW Stout are here. And although a collaboration of their departments may feel like a scholastic faux pas, it's quite naturally productive. And let's begin our conversations here. The Wisconsin Arts Board. I have respect for this organization, one that so often has had to swim upstream against currents, political and otherwise, always working to keep the arts from being demoted to the back of the chow line. George Sugros is the executive director, a champion of keeping the arts sitting at or near the front of the bus. He's coming to Western Wisconsin, as he's done many times before, to participate in the annual Rural Arts Conference in Amory. Prior to that appearance, we thought we might renew our relationship. I was looking over your responsibilities and affiliations. Creation and presentation grants, creative community grants, arts education emphasis, Wisconsin Arts News, you're a compiler, I guess, agency liaison to the governor's office and legislature, as well as the Cultural Coalition of Wisconsin, the Governor's Council on Tourism, the Robert E. Gard Wisconsin Idea Foundation, Wisconsin Alliance for Arts Education, and the Wisconsin Foundation. For the arts, you are chairman, yes, of the National Creativity Network.
That's true.
That's yours too. Of those listed, George, I have questions about the following before we get into our topic at hand.
Sure.
There may be people in the audience who have ideas and don't know where to go to help them happen. Tell us briefly, if that's possible, about creation and presentation grants. Are there a lot of them out there? How are they applied for, et cetera, et cetera?
Sure. And so creation and presentation grants are for arts organizations that do a season's worth of producing art or presenting art or exhibiting art. Everything from our largest organizations in the state, like the Milwaukee Symphony and the Milwaukee Art Museum, to the Red Cedar Symphony, all come under that category of creation and presentation. And so if an organization is doing that kind of seasonal work, then that's the category for them. If they are doing project work that relates to either arts education, local arts development, or the traditional and ethnic arts, then our creative communities category is for them. And that doesn't have to be an arts organization. It can be a local community, it can be a local school. Any nonprofit can come with an arts-related project.
Is there an impressive figure out there as to how much in grants are bestowed every year?
We are giving over $1 million worth of grants every year, and that's not bad on a budget which is now about $1.6 million.
Yeah, no kidding.
So we're putting the money out into the field, and of course, our grants are all needing to be matched. So that's then, what, $3.2 million circulating out there. So we're really happy to be able to work with artists, arts organizations, and communities to do arts-related things.
All I can say is I see the Wisconsin Arts Board logo and shout-outs on a lot of programs. You guys are helping a lot of people. Now, others on the list we've talked about on the show before, but I'm curious whenever anything switches to the national level. Tell me just a little bit about the National Creativity Network.
Sure. You may remember back in 2008 and 2009, we did a task force report on arts and creativity in education.
Mm-hmm.
When we did that, it was announced in January of 2009. And who but came to speak at that conference but Sir Ken Robinson, the great education speaker and the person who has the most popular TED Talk in the TED realm. He was looking to start a national organization related to imagination, creativity, innovation in education, culture, and commerce. And having just come off the task force, they knew that Wisconsin would be good in that conversation. And since we started the network in 2010, I have been its board chair, and Sir Ken is our honorary chair.
Creativity and the arts are doing well, or at least people want them to.
Well, that's right. And I think we'd all be very proud of the creativity, going from the youngest of our citizens to the very oldest. And just as a side note around the National Creativity Network, that's not just about the arts. That's
okay.
about science, technology,
oh, sure, yeah.
engineering, math, neuroscience, all those kind of things where creativity comes to play.
Yeah, I think creativity's been lended to the arts maybe a little bit too much.
Yeah, Sir Ken will tell us that arts and creativity are not a compound word.
On the phone with George Sugros, Executive Director, Wisconsin Arts Board. We're going to segue now to our topic at hand, which is the annual Rural Arts Conference for Northwest Wisconsin. It's coming up Friday, June 29th. It's 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Northern Lake Center for the Arts in Amory. You rub elbows, George, with lots of big city artsy types at conventions and events in large metro areas. I'm interested in your perspective on and your impression of the health of the arts in what big city folks might call the boondocks. You're coming back to Amory, Wisconsin, where people like Lemoyne McLaughlin have as big of an appetite for the arts as anyone else, and they find a way to provide it for themselves. I'm going to guess you might be a big fan of that kind of ingenuity.
Well, you know, Wisconsin is very famous for rural arts. In fact, the very first grant to the National Endowment for the Arts for rural arts support came from Wisconsin back in 1965. We have a long pedigree, especially the Wisconsin idea in reaching the borders of the state. But the truth of the matter is groups like Northern Lakes Center for the Arts are major organizations in their town. So it's all based on the scale of the community. And Lemoyne and Mary Ellen and all the folks at Northern Lakes have for years invited people who are interested in local arts in the rural space to a really nice gathering to connect one another, which I think is hugely important because a lot of times people feel like they're working in isolation. So first they connect and they learn from each other and they get inspired to go back and do more work. And of course for us, and I know you're going to talk with Ann Katz as well, for us it becomes the Johnny Appleseeds of Wisconsin. We get to tell those stories in other communities. And more than once we have said in an urban space, you think you can't do this? Well, look at what's being done in this rural space.
Yeah.
Because they are getting after it and they're getting it done.
What's happening, at least from my perspective, is people are finding ways to collaborate in ways they may not have in the past. Is that okay?
I think that's a brilliant way of saying it. And it's because of the rural examples in the smaller communities. Land O'Lakes is one that we've been to multiple times. They've got a gallery downtown in the community, but it's making impact. So one of the teachers that came up every summer to teach at that little rural gallery space is now chosen to move to that community. That's a kind of impact that doesn't necessarily show up on anybody's radar screen, but people notice.
Would I be right to say a lot of big things have come from discussion in small places, like the Rural Arts Conference? People come to these things and they talk about stuff and they listen to George and Ann and they hear what's going on all over the state of Wisconsin and they say, as you alluded to earlier, I could apply that where I live. Or I'm imagining a great big event that goes on somewhere in Wisconsin may have had its seed germinated in a place like Amory.
Most definitely. And you can point all the way back to Arts Wisconsin itself. If it wasn't for Lemoyne serving on the very early boards of Arts Wisconsin doesn't exist today. So the rural space has been very important in all kinds of things, up to and including Arts Wisconsin. And you're right, people come to hear what's going on in Madison, et cetera, but they're also coming to say, you know, we're having this challenge in our community. Anybody else faced this before? It's a peer-to-peer kind of learning, which I think is actually sometimes the best kind.
In recent years, we've talked about funding cuts. You alluded to them earlier, and there were clouds on the arts horizon. Am I wrong to think that we're overcoming many of those odds and actually feeling a bit of a renaissance?
The people in the arts are never deterred by those kinds of things. In fact, they redouble their efforts. What's interesting about it is the National Endowment for the Arts in the last 2 years, when faced with elimination, has actually gone up $3 million in the last fiscal year and will go up another $2 million if things stay the way they're headed in the Congress. So the Congress is putting money and investing money into this space, which I think is important. Private sector people are doing the same. Uh-huh. You know, go back to Eau Claire and see what happened to the hotels springing up around the Pablo Center. You can see it right there. So it is learning new ways of raising money, earned income, grants, all of that's coming together. But it is certainly fueling the Renaissance, mm-hmm. as you say.
How often does the Wisconsin Arts Board collaborate with people and or groups who have nothing to do with the arts? How often do collaborations like that result in wonderful things?
The very perfect example is the Wisconsin Science Festival. Mm. The Arts Board is a co-founder of the Wisconsin Science Festival, which might be a surprise to everybody. But again, it's about imagination, creativity, and innovation. And in the case of the Science Festival, it's explaining the arts through the sciences and explaining the sciences through the arts. And so this year it'll come up October 11th through the 14th. And it is a statewide activity. So mm-hmm. if people within the sound of your voice and my voice say, I want to get involved in doing something science-related during that time, they just need to reach out to the Science Festival, let them know what they're doing, and they become part of the mix. And, Al, you'll be surprised to learn that in the last 2 years, the events outside of Madison, which, of course, is where it was born, are more than the events inside of Madison. So, yeah.
You're right. I am surprised.
And it's local libraries and it's local children's museums when they're there, and it's all kinds of groups that are getting behind it. And the barriers to entry, there's no fee to get their event associated with something like that. So you're right, those kinds of collaborations bear some very, very interesting fruit.
It's called the annual Rural Arts Conference for Northwest Wisconsin. It's Friday, June 29th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., Northern Lake Center. For the Arts in Amory, I guess anybody can attend. Admission, registration, lunch, free of charge. Can't get better than that.
No, you can't. And in fact, the only thing I'd say is if they'd like to reach out to Lemoyne and Mary Ellen, just let them know they're coming so they can make sure the potluck is ready for them.
Yes. Well, or bring a dish.
There, that's right. Good idea.
How about that? Here's the way I've said it. It begins with supporting the arts, and it ends with, well, if you support the arts, it doesn't end.
That's right.
Okay. George Sugros, thanks for being with us.
Al, thank you.
Interest in the Wisconsin Science Festival at the website wisconsinsciencefest.org. And if you're impressed with what the Wisconsin Arts Board is doing, visit their website, artsboard.wisconsin.gov. Coming up on Spectrum West, the aforementioned conversation with Ann Katz of Arts Wisconsin, Jim Oliver and a new friend, and an alliance for clean water. Next. Support for WPR comes from Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona, previewing the National Eagle Center's collection of eagles in American culture, ranging from John James Audubon to Andy Warhol. MMAM.org. Well, we've talked previously about Menominee's Lakes REU project. One of the architects is Nels Paulsen, a UW Stout sociology professor. In general, it's about cleaning up Lake Menominee. It's diverse and involved and is dependent on people getting involved. Well, how about students of design? Well, if that sounds like a stretch, it is. It stretches the vision and opens new doors, as you'll see in this conversation with Paulsen and Eric Evanson, who teaches design. Nels, I need a little refresher course on the Lakes REU project. I don't need it, but I'd like our audience to have it in case they weren't here the last one or two times you've been here.
Sure thing. The Lakes REU, it stands for Linking Applied Knowledge and Environmental Sustainability Research Experience for Undergraduates. So REUs, or Research Experience for Undergraduate Sites, are funded by the National Science Foundation as a mechanism to train students who are underrepresented in the scientific community, undergraduate students, for graduate school. We were awarded this grant from the National Science Foundation to specifically study phosphorus pollution, blue-green algae bloom, which is a massive problem globally, but especially around here and near UW-Stout. So it's an interdisciplinary research project, involves research from biologists and economists and sociologists archaeologists and geologists and anthropologists and so on to study a lot of different angles where the problem comes from, but more importantly, how to move forward with improving the watershed.
So, Eric, before we talk about the specifics of the job that design grad students were given, let's get to know you a bit. You're an illustrator with a nice resume of work. Tell us about some of your past projects.
I got into graphic design out of art school. I kind of studied fine art and became sort of a graphic designer, illustrator hybrid. Dipped my toe into the comics world a few times.
How's that feel?
It's the water's warm.
Oh, good, 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 good.
I have a couple graphic novels out. The one I'm most known for is called Gods of Asgard. Came out in 2007, but in the last few years, I've been fortunate enough to do some work with the Ghostbusters and Back to the Future comic series well. But I've actually had a really broad experience in art and design. My position at UW-Stout is actually a generalist position, so I kind of bounce between some different areas, including the graduate class that I taught, some digital imaging classes, digital illustration, design drawing, design thinking.
Well, bouncing is good if you enjoy it.
It's fun.
Well, let's talk a bit about, because I think it's both important and fascinating, the depths research-wise, and the research leads to strategies.
The problems that we end up solving can often be pretty complex and difficult to define and difficult to solve. And so that's kind of what gets us excited, I think. I think a lot of creative thinkers actually get pretty excited about doing exactly that, solving the unsolvable, or at least attempting to. And design research is meant to be a part of that process. It's the front end of any design project. You kind of line up what you know and you line up what you don't know, or what you think you know and what you think you don't know. And then you attempt to support that with even more information. And this class was a graduate class. Yeah, they were able to do a real deep dive with this project.
Creating family-friendly activities centered on educating about clean water. What is that's the title? And
sure.
The design.
I don't think we've come up with a title yet. One of the things that we have been discussing is creating an outdoor science museum as a tourist attraction in Menominee that focuses on water and educates about water in an interactive way. We got to come up with a name for this.
So, Nels, was this collaboration a natural? Did you immediately know where to go, or was it a pleasant surprise?
Super pleasant surprise. A few years ago, I had an undergraduate student who was looking for a senior thesis project.
Okay.
And what I suggested to him, because he had an interest in GIS, which is like computer mapping, geographic information systems, I talked to him about creating a rain garden in Menominee that's in a big location that's very visible. And so he worked with the city and the county, and they ended up establishing this rain garden in Menominee at Lakeside Park, which is kind of close to the library. It's a boat landing. And Bobolink Nursery and a lot of different stakeholders were involved. The Tainter-Menominee Lake Improvement Association implemented this rain garden. And I ended up thinking that maybe the importance of this rain garden was not taking care of all the water pollution by itself, but as an educational site about rain gardens. So I ended up working with a Stout professor and his signage and exhibition class. That class ended up developing signage that we're in the process of, what do they call it?
Fabricating
yeah. Right now.
That's a good one.
And hopefully that'll be launched sometime this summer. But I realized that upon talking with another biology professor, Arthur Nieland at Stout, that if we thought of all of Menominee as a museum, we could have educational sites like this throughout the entire city.
Yeah.
And so I put kind of a call out to different art and design professors, and Eric thought it was cool. So I carefully tried to show not too eager. Maybe we should grab some beers, Eric?
Yeah.
So we got
that
beers
was
going to
be
Abbey.
My question. Did this happen over a beer?
It happened over a couple of beers.
It absolutely did.
Good
and,
for you. Some of the best things happen that way.
It's true. So, yeah. Yeah, completely lucked into it.
These kinds of projects, these kinds of classes are better when there are, I guess, problems that you can tackle from an undefinable amount of angles.
Sure.
And this is one of them. And so it seemed like a really natural fit. We had talked about it a little bit in the initial conversation that we had and then also in class. Designers are not going to be scientists, and we're not going to be sociologists or economists or entomologists or food science people or anything. And so the ways we can contribute to this problem, that's a limited approach that we have, but we can do what we do well. So I think when people are faced with a problem like this, their first instinct is to go straight to the science. How do we solve these problems in the watershed? But that's not what we can do. And so it helped us to reframe, I think, the entire project and gave the students something to really sink their teeth into.
This may have been a real breath of fresh air for design students, because very often they're involved in just come up with a design to advertise something or to push something like the newest golf ball or the whatever.
Yeah. And our graduate students, for the most part, are working adults as well. They're working in advertising or in graphic design or something right now as they're taking classes. And so they're, you know, they have to kind of shift gears a little bit from a more commercial world to this more socially empowered way of thinking.
That's the voice of Eric Evanson. He's an assistant professor of design at UW-Stout. And over on mic number three is Nels Paulsen. He's an associate professor of sociology and co-director of Lakes REU. So where are we on the museum concept?
It's in its infancy. And so the types of design concepts that his students were able to come up with were prototypes. They were more archetypes than prototypes, right? So they were... these are different categories of what this museum could be if thinking writ large besides like our basic edifice that we think of as a classic museum. So that's the excitement and opportunity. But it of course, depends on funding. And, you know, Eric and I are working with some environmental science professors on doing a component of the university's larger capital campaign to see if we can come up with some funds to make this a reality. And we definitely need to integrate this with the city of Menominee and the larger community to make it actually effective, but also, you know, absorb as a new initiative that everybody's excited about. In Menominee, the inertia is definitely in the positive direction. People really want to do whatever they can to make sure that everybody is on board with cleaning it up and understands the sources and understands the strategies that are going to be most effective and wants to invest financially as a community into those strategies. The benefit of this museum is that it could be something that draws people in by itself and stimulates the economy, helps develop the culture of Menominee with the university, not separate from the university. So that in itself, I think, is enough of a sell. But if it can actually help to stimulate other initiatives, I can't see it as anything besides a win-win.
The shape of the future is in the hands of the young people. What's being imagined is places all around.
Early on, I mean, maybe it ends up being just one place. I mean, I would love it if there were experiential, like a children's museum kind of game exhibits that could survive year-round with relatively low maintenance that were positioned in strategic places throughout the city. But then there's one place that's sort of the central information hub. I mean, ideally, it'd be great if we rebuilt the boathouse that used to exist there 100 years ago on Lake Menominee and had that as a central like edifice that pushed people to these other locations throughout the city.
But, you know, there you go imagining again. And that's Eric's job.
That's right,
Wow. But it's a good illustration of the fact that the scope really hasn't been defined. We can define it as we go in a lot of ways, limited to basically money, time, interest, and executability. It's a good place to be in, I think.
It's kind of a cliche, but it's safe to say this is still in the design stage.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It is.
So now, I couldn't help but to think after reading this story, herein lies the beauty of UW-Stout as an institution of higher learning in that departments are depending on other departments in ways that they may not have imagined. Water quality and design, not exactly an instant match, if you know what I mean.
You know, and there's been too little of that, you know, that we end up promoting these universities as very narrow vocational training spaces. And we know that most of the jobs that exist today will not exist in 20 years.
Except for radio, thank
God. The mentality behind these jobs are what we need to train them for, and a lot of that needs to be collaboration and knowledge about a lot of different disciplines and skills. And so I think the more that Stout can move towards what's classically more of a liberal arts kind of training, I think that only benefits what's already there as a polytechnic university in developing all of these, you know, very specific skills. So hopefully, yeah, this is the movement towards the future. It needs to be, I think.
I also think it ties into the overall mission of Stout, the whole hands-on applied learning concept, which is as relevant to social science as it is to biology, as it is to the arts and design. The way Nels originally sort of pitched this at me was, this is exactly what we all do. And if we can all kind of approach it from a different angle, it's a way to identify ourselves, carve out an identity and a niche for ourselves that doesn't maybe exist otherwise.
Well, and it kind of redefines your jobs. I mean, it makes your jobs that much more interesting.
Yeah.
So you'll keep us posted.
Oh, yeah. I think that even if we do get an influx of funds and we do like a big launch on something to start with, I think the benefit of thinking of this as an entire city as a museum and these different exhibits throughout is that we roll out new exhibits each year that are built upon community feedback on what they want to learn about and they want to have their children experience. And that would make sure that this is always new and fresh and involving new students and new collaborations.
Nels Paulsen and Eric Evanson, both professor guys at UW Stout. Thanks for being with us. You guys have a good initiative.
Well, thanks so much.
Thank you
for having us.
Just like lakes are monitored for blue-green algae, we'll monitor the progress and be thankful we have people like Nels and Eric willing to dive in and make it as good as it can be. And I'm talking the lake as well as the education process. Well, what do you say we take a look at what's on stage in Western Wisconsin here on Spectrum West? Here's Jim Oliver.
Thank you, sir, and welcome back. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild will present the musical State Fair June 28th through July 1st at the State Theater in Eau Claire. Disney's Aladdin Kids will be presented in the Oxford Theater twice daily, June 28th, 29th, and 30th by the Eau Claire Children's Theater. The Northern Star Theater of Rice Lake will stage a musical version of Anne of Green Gables, June 28th through July the 1st. Mary Poppins will be staged by the Neillsville Area Players Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and the following Saturday and Sunday in the Neillsville High School. The Red Barn Theater of Rice Lake is presenting the Hallelujah Girls through June the 30th. The Fantastics will be staged by the Festival Theater through July 8th in the Franklin Square Black Box in St. Croix Falls. And the Falls Players will stage The Addams Family, the Broadway musical, through Sunday in the Lunda Theater in Black River Falls. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
There he is, rested and refreshed after a couple of weeks' respite. Now, let's see with whom he shares this week's conversation.
As the Anishinaabe, or the Ojibwe, slowly migrated into the Lake Superior region centuries ago, they were met by a potent adversary, the Dakota Sioux, who fiercely resisted their spread into its territory. Gradually, the Anishinaabe pushed them out of the northern woodlands and into the plains to the south. This long-running and bloody conflict lies at the heart of the story of the 13. Here to talk about the 13 is its author, Dr. Lauren Robinson, who is the former chair of the journalism department at the University of Wisconsin-River Falls and founder and former manager of the school's radio station. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Thanks, Jim. Happy to be here.
You write in the book that its beginning came more than 30 years ago, so tell us about that history.
I'm not sure about your life, Jim, or the lives of your listeners, but mine has been pretty much dictated by serendipity. As you know, things come along sometimes that are positive, sometimes negative, and if you get lucky, sometimes you're able to convert some of these serendipitous events into something positive, and that is the case with the book The 13. Some 35 years ago, I attended a cocktail party at the university with a good friend of mine who was an historian, Dr. Walker Wyman. And Dr. Wyman was a specialist in Native American studies and other facets of Native life. And he, at that party, mentioned to me a story. He collected stories, of course, from the Native American folklore and history. And this one was very powerful, but he had only very, very sketchy information about it. It was very, very bare bones. But it was the story of the 13 Anishinaabe or Ojibwe teenagers who sought to regain the honor of their band after their village was devastated by raiding Dakota. it occurred to me then that there was the potential there for a truly powerful, you know, story, book, novel, and I filed it away in my mental filing cabinet, and so there it sat for about 33 years until I recently got to it and decided to try to write the book. Walker died in 1999. He was an old gentleman when I knew him, and I checked back into his scholarly production on file at the university in the archives and looked for any references to that story because, again, he had only the barest of information about it. I found nothing, so he didn't pursue it. So I was left with this very, very broad and general outline to work with.
I'm going to ask you about the research process and all of that.
Sure.
But give us an idea what the story's about.
Yeah, as I mentioned, because of this long-running battle between the two tribes, it goes back centuries to even before the arrival of the white man on the continent. There were so many incidents of battles and fights back and forth and back and forth. And one of the facets of Native American culture is the notion of honor, of regaining honor through retribution, revenge as necessary. That's a thread which runs through, you know, a lot of different tribal histories. And that certainly was the case here. Again, at this point, when this raid took place on the part of the Dakota, or as they're now often known, Sioux, on the Anishinaabe or the Ojibwe village, naturally, there was a tendency to want to get revenge for what the Dakota had done. The fascinating part about this, the tribal elders, as the story goes, did not want to seek immediate revenge. They instead wanted to rebuild the village and try and get things back in order before heading out to try to get retribution. But hotheads in the tribe, young men, didn't agree, and they, against the expressed wishes of the elders, decided to form their own war party and go off and do the deed themselves. And these were teenagers. It was an amazing kind of commitment to honor. The book is about that adventure or venture and the effort to regain the honor of the band by these teenagers and the outcome of this effort. The book is a parable in many ways. It deals with the very basic and still very pertinent question, what is honor, and what is the price of honor? The book also is, I think, a rather poignant coming-of-age story for the youngest of the 13. He struggles with trying to come to grips with the aftermath, so that's also a very key ingredient in the book. I placed the story in what I call a time, before the arrival of whites on this continent. I did so because I wanted to tell the story in the purest possible form, without the distractions of all the stuff that the whites brought, you know, alcohol and guns and diseases and, of course, the clock, thus time before time, and the major changes politically and socially and so on that were imposed upon the Native Americans by the arrival of the whites. So I placed it a number of centuries ago before they actually were on the scene.
We're talking to Dr. Lauren Robinson, who is author of The 13, an American Indian historical tale. There is some graphic violence in the book. Do you recommend it for teens or even older teenagers?
That's a very good question, Jim, and one I struggled with. I believe, and my publisher agrees, that it's essentially an adult novel. However, we believe also there's crossover potential. We think that the upper age range within what's called young adult readers would be appropriate for the book as well, 16 to 18-year-olds.
I found it to be a very moving book. I just recommend it to anybody.
I really appreciate that, Jim, because, again, it just came out in late May, and I am getting quite a few reviews on the online bookseller sites like Amazon, and right now I have about 12 reviews online, and I'm running 5-5 in terms of 5 stars. I'm really pleased. Those folks who do read the book seem to find it's a worthwhile read, so yeah. I'm happy to report that.
Yeah. Well, I've told you some of my personal experience about trying to do research into American Indian lore and have little success. How did you go about researching all of this?
Well, fortunately, Anishinaabe Ojibwe have a really long and rather involved and complete oral history. they tell us the tale themselves about how they came to northern Wisconsin and Minnesota, the Lake Superior region, over 1,000 years ago when they began to migrate from the East Coast, where they lived around the Gulf of St. Lawrence for millennia. And then they ran into the current residents of that area, the Dakota or Sioux, the bloody conflict that resulted over many centuries as they fought. So I had that record, which was very helpful. Also, it's interesting that the Ojibwe were the subject of a lot of studies starting in the early 1800s, by people, writers, and adventurers who would find them and live with them for some time. There were many books written about the tribe. So the cultural aspect, the customs, the language, the religious aspects were pretty well documented. And since that doesn't change a great deal, I could project that back into the earlier times when I placed the story. There also are quite a few Ojibwe authors, some scholars and others who have written about the history of the tribe. Those are great resources because they have done a lot of the research, which I really didn't have time to do in terms of original research. I was able to find a lot of information I needed from those sources as well. So the information is there, and it just takes time to ferret it out and use it. My writing style is maybe interesting. I don't do a lot of research at the outset. I had, in this case, a rough outline of the story, and I knew what the story was and kind of where it went. But as I wrote, I began to find things I needed to find out, and so I would just kind of sequentially find things and plug them in and use them. One review that I had by a professional reviewer who writes for Midwest Book Review talked about the authenticity of the book. Mm-hmm. She said it rings with authenticity, and I like that phrase a great deal because it indicates I did my job pretty well in terms of trying to write authentically about the tribe, their customs, linguistics, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. So do you plan any more historical fiction around American Indians?
No, I don't, actually. I really enjoyed writing the book. I enjoyed learning a lot, especially about the Ojibwe Anishinaabe. And I have a well-worn copy of the Ojibwe English Dictionary, for example. And I've learned a few phrases, and I did integrate, as you know, a number of words and phrases from the language to, again, help increase the authenticity of the work. But I have another book which I've started, which, again, is historical fiction, but a totally different story. It's a story that involves World War II. I'm a photographer by background also, and I collect cameras. And I collected a 1936 Leica, a beautiful, beautiful camera that I just love, in pristine condition. And I began to think that was, of course, built in Germany during the run-up to the war, and it was built at a time when the Nazi Party was taking over. And I kind of wondered after a time, you know, where has this camera been? What has it seen? What images has it been used to take over these some 80 years since it was built, again, just before the famous Olympics in 36 in Germany? Mm-hmm. So the novel is about the camera, essentially, as it moves from hand to hand, and it focuses on what the camera was exposed to, both in the European and the Pacific theaters. So it's a big challenge, but a very fun concept, I think, a new way to look at the war from a different perspective.
Yeah, for sure. Well, where's the book available?
I wish you could go to any bookstore and buy it on the shelves, but of course you can't. The literary market is so glutted. There are literally 1 million books published in this country alone every year. The vast majority are, in fact, designed for the mass market. So the competition is just incredible. So it's hard to get the books on the shelves. But any bookstore will be happy to order a copy, for readers. Mm-hmm. If not that, then they can go to any of the online booksellers, an Amazon or a Barnes & Noble, for example, and have it delivered either to their e-reader or delivered to their homes.
Well, we've been talking to Lauren Robinson, author of The 13, an American Indian historical tale of a group of Ojibwe teenagers who seek to restore the honor of their tribe. Thanks so much for being with us. I enjoyed the book thoroughly, and I wish you well with it.
Jim, my pleasure.
Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Simply Done in Downsville, a place for gifts, ideas, and space for events. Home of Dunn County Pottery, featuring wood-fired pottery and fair trade gifts. More at simply-dunn.com. The mission of Arts Wisconsin is to serve the people of Wisconsin and enrich communities as the voice for the arts in the state. Founded in 92, Arts Wisconsin is the only independent statewide organization providing a leadership forum for advancing the local and statewide creative economy, integrating the arts and creativity in education, educating entrepreneurs and activists, and engaging policymakers and the public as a catalyst for dialogue, information, and action. Ann Katz is executive director. Like George Sugros, heard earlier in the program, she's also coming to Amory for the Rural Arts Conference and has collaborated with the Leagues of Wisconsin Municipalities on a report called 21st Century Wisconsin. It turns out that 75% of our conversations on this week's program have to do with collaboration. We do on this week's show talk with George Sugros of the Wisconsin Arts Board about all sorts of collaborations. We also listen this week to a couple UW Stout professors discussing their unlikely fortuitous partnership. And here we are on the telephone with Ann Katz of Arts Wisconsin about their collaboration with the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. Now, Ann, before we get into what you've been up to together, tell us about the importance of collaboration and relationships in a world like yours.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, Al. In a world like all of ours, I believe that we are all stronger together. And that is borne out by the work that we do statewide with the League of Municipalities, the Wisconsin Arts Board, and many other public and private partners, and on the local and regional levels with the people that are really doing the work on the ground. The resources that we can bring to the table as a statewide organization and the resources that people, businesses, organizations, communities have from their ground-up perspective, It, when you put those things together, it's an unstoppable force. So I learn a lot from our partners. We keep trying to achieve great things together. Mm-hmm. So I'm a big fan of the arts and everything else working together in partnership.
One of the neat things about our conversations about collaborations had to do with the fact that they do surprise you once in a while. People come along and they're from a realm that you never really thought of working together with, but you do, and you find out that it's mutually beneficial.
Absolutely. From our point of view, the arts are not separate from people's lives. Mm-hmm. It's not that some people are artists and some people are not. And it's not that some people participate in the arts and some people don't. Pretty much everyone is involved in a creative endeavor, and every community has creative people and resources that they can benefit from. So when you start to really explore the arts and everything else, it is a pretty powerful force.
Yeah. George Sugros and I talked about the spotlights that have been aimed at Eau Claire now because of collaborations that are producing some pretty wonderful places downtown. And your report, called 21st Century Wisconsin, does the same for points all across Wisconsin. If we were to dive into many of the facts and figures found in that report, we could devote an entire hour to it.
But that's for sure.
Today, we're only going to be a segment. So can you thumbnail for our audience what the report says about the creative economy in Wisconsin overall?
The report says that the arts are a force for Wisconsin already. And we make the case that with partnerships and investment, there can be even greater things happening. One of the talking points I've been using recently are that in terms of jobs in Wisconsin, right now we have about 31,000 papermaking jobs, and the paper industry is a historical industry for Wisconsin. There are about 35,000 biotech jobs, and that's part of the 21st century economy. And even more part of the 21st century economy, there are over 91,000 creative industry jobs in the state already. And so we're making the case with this report and the advocacy that we do that Wisconsin has all the assets it needs to succeed in the 21st century economy, which demands a focus on creativity, innovation, imagination, entrepreneurship. We already have all the assets we need. It's really time that we achieve our greatness and really become a global leader in creativity by investing in those resources. So, you know, as you said, we could reel off numbers. I could spend several hours telling you about all the many things happening in the state, mm-hmm. from Eau Claire to the smallest town to Milwaukee. This report puts a lot of that information into one place so that we can spread it around.
That's the voice of the executive director of Arts Wisconsin, Ann Katz, on the phone with us, and we're talking about a report in general called 21st Century Wisconsin, done in collaboration with the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. And many Americans' lips are flapping about trade lately, with varying opinions on how much we send and how much we receive. I was interested to read that Wisconsin arts exports a lot more than it imports, like $20 billion more. What kinds of things does Wisconsin export?
Well, our global media presence, I think, is probably the biggest export. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, our Hollywood movies, our music, that goes around the world. That's in every corner of the world, thanks to the wonders of the interwebs. And so when we look at the arts in a bigger sense, not only are the nonprofit arts organizations and the individual artists and performers that are actually doing the work, but then we get to the bigger picture of media, music, sure. Film, all that kind of stuff. It really is a huge powerhouse, and we are talking about billions with a B when we get to that point. Uh-huh. One of the data points in this report is from the U.S. Department of Commerce Bureau of Economic Advisors that says that in Wisconsin, the impact, monetary impact of the arts economy is $9.1 billion, again, with a B. Uh-huh. And so that's great. And that's a starting point because, again, with even just a little bit of investment, although the more investment, the better, we can keep growing that section of the 21st century economy to really take advantage of what we have to offer here.
How cool is it to say we have a trade surplus? And by the
yes,
by the way,
for
but,
these days, for sure.
Yeah, and I want people to know that that's the truth. Yeah.
Yes, okay. It is absolutely true.
We do have a trade surplus. As I said earlier, we could toss out numbers till those beautiful Wisconsin cows come home. But what this report also says to us, we need to keep up the good work. And in order to do that, we must invest. You've used that word several times now. In
that
arts,
is the word.
In arts and creativity to keep things going. That's got to be a big part of why Arts Wisconsin operates. Looking back and looking around is nice, but looking ahead is the direction that really matters.
Yes, we are very focused on looking ahead. And, you know, we're all about development, advocacy, service, and connections. And so our job is to make note of what's happening around the state, bring it together, and really promote the fact that it's a powerhouse for Wisconsin. We use the word investment because it's not that money invested in any industry, but especially the arts, just sort of floats off into the ether. This is an investment in jobs. It's an investment in business. It's an investment in civic engagement and civic vitality. You know, our communities are known for what's happening creatively, and that's everything from the Pablo Center in Eau Claire to the Northern Lakes Center for the Arts in Amory to the St. Croix Falls Auditorium, which is being revitalized.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sort of reaching for a few of the examples in Western Wisconsin. There are many creative people working, making that part of the state known. And again, we deserve to be better known for the things that are happening around the state.
Yeah, as you alluded, Friday, June 29th, you will be within the city limits of charming Amory, Wisconsin. Conferences like that annual Rural Arts Conference is where seeds are planted, because success and vision are not only found off the freeways of big cities, as you can well attest.
One of the great pleasures of my job and one of the most important things is that I get to travel around the state and actually see what's happening on the ground. I can tell you that there are great things happening in the cities and there are great things happening in small towns. Wisconsin is really rich with authentic, unique, handmade, homegrown experiences and efforts coming up from the grassroots. You know, Western Wisconsin is a hotbed of that kind of activity. And it doesn't matter the size of the community. People are still working really, really hard. They're still making things happen. And, you know, our job is to promote that.
Yeah, and more so than just the bare talent that all these artistic people have, I am most impressed with their energy and their unwillingness
to stop,
to slow down, even when people are saying, well, you can't have as much funding as you used to have, and you can't have this, and it's not as good as it used to be. But these people just find a way.
That keeps me going, that's for sure. And, you know, I mean, when we talk about things like funding, we're really trying to make the case, you know, that's why I keep saying investment, that there needs to be more investment and funding. We're not talking about gazillions of dollars. We're talking about leveraging from the state level and the federal level what's happening on the local level, because people are working very hard. And there's never going to be a moment in time where everybody has all the money they need and, you know, they can relax. The fact that people are working hard and trying to find the resources that fuel the ideas that make their communities come alive, it's really a very special thing about Wisconsin and the people here, that we care so much about our communities. Doesn't matter what side of the political aisle you're on, doesn't matter anything. You will still want to make your community better for your kids.
Yeah.
And that's what I see happening around the state.
Well said. Finally, access is vital, as we all know. How do people access Arts Wisconsin resources, and can they access the report, the 21st Century Wisconsin?
Yes. ArtsWisconsin.org, and that's arts and Wisconsin all written out, all one word, ArtsWisconsin.org. And if you go to that site, you can get to the report, and there's a lot of other information about what's happening in the arts in Wisconsin and the work that Arts Wisconsin does.
Learn how you can invest in tomorrow. Ann Katz, thanks so much for being with us on Spectrum West and Wisconsin Public Radio. Always
Thank
a pleasure.
You.
I hope to do it again soon.
Thanks, Al. Take care.
Wow. Together on the same show, Arts Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Arts Board. Now remember, the word heart has a lot of art in it. 60%, as a matter of fact. Quick Spectrum Memos. Tonight, Thursday, Sounds Like Summer Concert Series. Phoenix Park Eau Claire features Parker Reed, Laska, plus Nick Anderson and the Skinny Lovers. Music in the Park and Ladysmith Memorial Park happens every Thursday. Tonight, Thursday, features Laura and Friends. Colfax Music in the Park. No music tonight, Thursday, because it's the Colfax Fair. What's next? 24th annual Rock the Riverfront Run Walk is Saturday at Phoenix Park. Check out the Royal Credit Union Foundation website. One of the beneficiaries is Literacy Chippewa Valley. Thanks, Cora, Dean, and Kate, all making my life easier each week. Good to be back in the saddle. Next week, new recorded music from a regional favorite. It's a brand new season chock full of entertainment at Hudson's Phipps Center and more. I'm Al Ross for Jim Oliver. Thank you so much. We'll do it again next week. See you then.